It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As we head into the biggest shopping weekend of the year, we're going to take some time today to talk about the true cost of cheap goods on labor, on economics, and on the environment. We'll also find out what happens to all the stuff that we buy when we don't want it anymore. But we're going to start the hour with something called the Unshopping Challenge. A group of students at the University of Northern Iowa decided to take the challenge, 30 days of buying nothing but necessities, and two of those students are here with me now. Allie Albright is here. Hello, Allie.
Hi, how are we doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Connor Tomke is also here. Hello, Connor.
Hey, guys.
Thanks a lot for being here. And Allie, why don't you start us off? What was the goal of this challenge?
So our challenge was posed by our capstone class, and basically it was a community engagement challenge. So we had a lot of options. Our instructor gave us pretty much free range to decide what we wanted to do. And earlier in the class, we had talked about the Unshopping Challenge, and a lot of us had shown interest in that. So we decided to take it upon ourselves to pursue this challenge and unshop for 30 days.
And what are the rules of the challenge?
The rules of the challenge is that you cannot buy any unnecessary items. So clothing, jewelry, toys, games, anything like that. Basically, the only things you can purchase are necessary items like groceries, bills, and gas.
What about like going out for dinner, going out for drinks, or going to a concert, that kind of thing?
There's no strict rules on that. It's kind of up to the person. So really, it's kind of the goals you want to set for yourself. Obviously, if you want to restrict going out to eat, if that's a problem for you, that can be one of your goals. So you can definitely exclude that from the challenge. But the challenge itself does not exclude going out or going to concerts and stuff. But that's what's great about this challenge. You can kind of edit it to yourself, so you can kind of challenge yourself in these 30 days.
Well, Connor, what made you decide to get involved in this?
The really thing that got to me, I guess, was the opportunity at the end of this challenge that we were going to hold the drive where we were going to collect all the things that we didn't use for a month. And we've been hanging up flyers at UNI and around so people can bring their clothes that they didn't wear or things they didn't use for those 30 days. And with all that clothes, we're going to be able to give it away, either to Goodwill or I'm trying to work with Waterloo Schools to see if we can give some of the clothes there. But I thought the charity aspect was really cool.
So if you didn't use something in that 30-day period, was that supposed to be an indicator that it's not something you need?
Yeah. I mean, it's for like especially clothes, like a tuxedo I'm going to still keep because I'll need that. But for just like random T-shirts and jeans that I don't wear, we're just going to give those away for people that could use them.
What for you did you expect before you started? And then we'll talk about what actually was the most challenging part. But before you started, Connor, what did you think the most challenging part of this would be for you?
I didn't really think it was going to be too challenging because I don't really shop a ton in general. But then I'd always find myself like on Amazon Prime, like looking around at little things I kind of want to buy, which was always just kind of a small habit. And then it's just like little things that you kind of like to have here and there. But then just trying to restrict yourself to not buying those things was kind of a hassle. But
all right, so you thought it was going to be easy for you.
Yeah, because I don't really shop a ton in general, but it was kind of a hassle.
All right. Well, Allie, you were going into this with sort of an extra challenge because you also work in retail, which must be an environment that encourages you to buy stuff all the time.
It does. I work in a place of retail, so I'm just surrounded by stuff all day, and it's fun stuff. It's stuff that I normally would enjoy shopping for. So that was just an extra challenge for me when I decided to start this 30-day challenge. But I was surprised at how easy I was to just say no to it.
And is shopping something that you have done for fun in the past? Is this one of your just pleasurable activities that you might do with friends?
Oh, yeah. My roommates and I, friends throughout the years, it's just a fun get-together thing to do. And even if it's just window shopping, even if you don't buy something that day, it's still a fun activity I enjoy.
So for you going into this, you probably expected it to be more challenging than Connor expected it to be.
I did. You know, it's different for girls, I would say, but I was pleasantly surprised with my willpower over the last 30 days to not buy anything. So I definitely expected it to be a lot harder for me, but I was pleasantly surprised with myself.
So how do you think this changed your mindset when you were in the same environment that you were normally a part of? How did it change how you think?
It really made me stop and think to differentiate between my wants and my needs. So with this challenge, if I was out, I'd still go out with my friends shopping because it's just an activity we like to do, but I would always restrain myself from buying something. And the way I kind of rationalized why I couldn't buy it is I'd make myself think, this is a want, this isn't a need. So that really helped me through this challenge. And I think that's a skill that I'll take with me through the rest of my life.
Did you have any moments during the challenge where you found yourself really struggling and think, well, maybe it's a need? Maybe
I do definitely.
Need this. So describe one of those moments.
Yeah, there's great sales going on. So at the mall, there was a great sale going on at one of the stores, and my friends were all, you know, getting in on this sale, and you feel like you're missing out on it. And I just had to rationalize, no, you're not missing out on it. This isn't something that's going to, you know, be the life or death of you. There will be more sales. You will be okay.
Any regrets? Did you find yourself thinking about something that you really wanted?
No. You know, you kick yourself at the moment for not taking advantage of the sale, but then 2 weeks later, you're completely fine and you've forgotten about it.
So, Connor, you said, again, that you didn't think that this would be a big challenge for you. Shopping isn't something that you do just for pleasure, not necessarily a hobby like it might be for Allie and some of her friends. But did you find that maybe you spend more money on things you don't need on a weekly or monthly basis than you actually thought you did?
Yeah, definitely. I would have like a tendency just to buy little things here and there that I didn't need. So like at Allie said, it just really came down to wants and needs. And, yeah, I mean, once in a while, like, you do think, oh, I kind of wish I would have bought that. But then when you look back a week later and you're checking your bank account and you have that money there, that's always a good reward, too. So,
well, and I can imagine that is the place that you saw the impact the most. Can you give us an idea of how significant that was? If you're not necessarily tracking your spending and you don't think you buy that much, were you surprised by the impact on your bank account?
Yeah, it actually was. I was like, oh, my God, I'm not as poor as I usually are. I think I am this time of the month. So I just look around. And it's like I don't buy a lot of big things, but when you just keep buying those little small things you don't need, they add up. So I became less afraid to check my bank account. So that was really nice.
How about you, Allie? Was it a big impact financially for you?
It definitely was. I definitely, just like Connor said, I was noticing I wasn't so much in the hole as I was at certain points during the month. So that's a very rewarding feeling to see that you've made it a noticeable and like real impact on your life.
So you took this challenge really the month before the big shopping season begins. And so you've completed the 30-day unshopping challenge, but we are heading into the holiday season. Black Friday is coming up. How do you think this changes your mindset going into a time of year when you would normally spend quite a bit, Allie?
I think I'm just going to realize that there's a great amount of knickknacks that come out this time of the year that, you know, they're very eye-catching and you think they'll make your life so much better and easier. But I think I'll be able to differentiate between what's going to make my life great for a week and what's going to make my life great for the rest of my life or for the rest of the life of that whatever product I'm buying. So I'm really going to be able to decide, is this worth it? Is this going to improve my life for the long haul and not just for the short amount of time I'm going to get joy out of this product?
Connor, what about you?
Yeah, I agree. I think that instead of me buying like material goods for gifts for family, for Christmas and stuff, I kind of want to go towards the route of buying like experiences. So instead of buying them some kind of material that they like for a week and then have it in the closet the rest of their life, we can just like make a memory and go do something fun. So that's kind of what I want to do.
What do you think about the environmental impact of this unshopping challenge? We've talked about the economic impact, at least on your personal finances. Allie, how did you think about your interaction with the planet during this challenge?
It's definitely been an eye-opening experience. In our class, we actually talked about what kind of damage stuff does to our environment and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that just comes from the production and use and destruction of our stuff is 42%, and that just blew my mind that stuff could make up such a large percentage of the damage we're doing to our environment. So that definitely made me it adds another layer of thought before I buy anything from now on.
Connor, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with Allie on that. Before we took the class, I really didn't know how much of an impact what we like bought had on the environment, but having the class was kind of an eye-opener, and it does take into a little account. It does help your bank account, which is nice, but it also feels good to know that you're kind of helping the planet, too.
Now, I followed along on the blog. A number of different students were taking this challenge. Did you guys kind of work together as a support group to keep each other strong, Allie?
Yep. Every once a week when we met for class, we talk about how we all were doing, if we'd have any struggles in the last week. And some of us did, but it was only a handful. So we all did really well overall.
How many students was it total?
Six.
All right. Did anybody fail the unshopping challenge?
Well, it's not a fail because, you know, they did restrain for the most part. But one or two did buy something that wasn't, you know, a necessary item. But, you know, it was good because then we talked about it. We talked about the thought process they went through when they bought it. And it was kind of like unshopping therapy for us once a week.
Well, and I can imagine when you finish the challenge, you could kind of go one of two ways. You could carry these ideas and this mindfulness with you, or you can engage in a lot of retail therapy, a lot of pent-up want. So, Allie, finishing the challenge, what's your response?
I think it's detoxed me of all the wants I used to have. So I'm hopeful, and I think I'll be able to go forward with this new mindset that I've developed over the past 30 days.
Connor, how about you?
I agree completely. It's really been eye-opening after the month is over just to look in my closet and see all the things I didn't wear or don't plan on wearing. I mean, I have shirts that are 4 or 5 years old that I haven't touched since I was a senior in high school. And I know if I buy a lot of these things, it's just going to please me for a week or two, and then they're going to end up in that pile. So I'll probably try to stay as much unshopping as I can, but just get the necessities.
All right. Well, thank you both for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Allie Albright and Connor Tomke are two of the students who have been taking part in the Unshopping Challenge, a capstone project for this group of students at the University of Northern Iowa. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you.
Yeah, me too.
We're going to continue our conversation about shopping in a moment. The high cost of cheap goods on the environment, on the economy, on labor. And we'll also talk about what happens to the stuff we don't want anymore once we take it out of our homes. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking about the unshopping challenge, but it's not just whether we do or do not buy things we don't need. What we buy, how it's made, and where it comes from is a big part of the puzzle. A little later on, we'll also talk about where all the stuff we don't want anymore goes. But let's start at the beginning. And with me now is Elizabeth Klein, author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hey, it's so good to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And let's go back to where this started for you. What made you want to research the fashion industry and understand where the items that you could buy for so little money were coming from?
Yeah, so maybe similar to the students that were on, Allie and Connor, I found myself just on a personal level at this place where I was shopping a lot, and I had ended up just accumulating a lot of very low cost clothes. And in Overdressed, I actually write about this moment where I buy the $7 pair of shoes and then it wears out in a couple of weeks. And so I just went back to the store and bought seven more pairs of $7 shoes. I just bought the store out of my size. And it was actually on that day when I was coming home from buying all those cheap shoes where I kind of had the, you know, my aha moment of, okay, what am I doing? Where is this stuff coming from? How can it be priced so cheaply? And what are the environmental and social ramifications of what I'm doing? And that sort of set me on the journey to write Overdressed and find those answers for myself.
Well, and it really underscores how so much of what we buy is almost disposable. I mean, those shoes only lasted a couple of weeks, so you were wearing shoes that you could just throw away when you were done with them.
Yeah, and I think that the idea of clothing being disposable is also a mindset, because even, you know, sometimes I'll, you know, or at least I used to, I would buy a cheaper garment And if I had taken care of it properly, it probably could have lasted for years, but that's not really how a lot of us approach clothing when we buy it nowadays. We're just thinking, is this cheap? Is it cute? And we don't really think ahead to, does this actually fit into my wardrobe? Am I going to get a lot of use out of it? So we think of clothing as being disposable when in reality, a lot of times it's not, and it persists. It persists in the environment. It creates a lot of waste, and it creates a huge, you know, environmental impact as well.
So when you set out to research this book, you were taking a look at the fashion industry, the textile industry, at a moment in time. But you also did some longitudinal research and looked at how things had changed over time. And I think that's one of the really shocking things that comes out of your research, showing how the clothing industry changed between the 1990s and into the 2000s. Can you give me an idea of how things have shifted in that time?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I came of age at a kind of the turning point from this older, slower system of fashion to what a lot of people in the industry today call fast fashion. And what describes or defines that slower system of fashion is, first of all, domestic production. You know, as recently as the 1990s, we were still making about half of our clothes in the United States. And today we're making between 2% and 3% of our clothes in the United States. But the other big difference is that in the 1990s, clothing retailers were still putting out, you know, 2 to 4 major collections per year. So you could go into a store and see something you like and come back weeks or even months later and it would still be there, and you could, you know, wait for it to go on sale. And as anyone listening today knows, now if you see something in a store, it's quite likely that a week from now it might be gone, because in this new fast system of retailing, inventory is turned over so quickly, and stores are just moving through far, far more product than they used to. And now we're kind of at a point where there's almost like 52, you know, micro seasons a year in the fashion industry. So the industry is just so much faster, and it's producing so much more stuff than it used to.
So you've traveled all over the world to visit these garment factories. And as you said, what, 2 to 3% of what we're making is being made now in the United States, or what we're buying is being made in the United States. So in traveling around the world and visiting these factories and finding out how it worked, what did you find?
I would say there, one of the most shocking things I learned, one was just the scale of the environmental impact of the fashion industry. You know, fashion just in recent years has earned the dubious distinction of being the second most polluting industry in the world now, behind the fossil fuel industry. And it's also one of the largest consumers and polluters of fresh water. And I think that for me, going to China really drove that point home, because there's, you know, areas in southern China where you look out and there are factories as far as the eye can see. It's really just like an ocean of factories. And the difference between a factory running in China versus in the United States is their environmental standards are still very, very behind ours. So they're struggling with air and water pollution. And then we're getting the cost savings in the store. We're not having to pay for that environmental toll in China. And if I may, I also was very shocked at the conditions in garment factories. I think that what gets missed in the conversation about sweatshops is that what's really disappointing about the way that garment factories operate in the new fast fashion system is that poverty wages have become so normalized. So in the United States, it was possible at some point to kind of work your way up into the middle class through a garment industry job, where today we're seeing people locked into cycles of poverty working in garment factories for decades at a time. And they're working for companies that make, you know, billions of dollars in profit every year. So I would say those are the two biggest things, biggest takeaways for me.
Well, and you talk about the jobs at factories overseas and that cycle of poverty. But I mean, the people that are working at those jobs, if they didn't have those jobs, they wouldn't necessarily have an income at all. So, I mean, it's a pretty complicated idea when we look at those very, very low wages. But in some cases, those are keeping a family afloat.
Well, right. That's used as a justification to continue exploitation. I'm not suggesting that that people in the developing world don't work in the garment industry. What needs to happen is there needs to be a more equitable share of the profits that are being earned. There's no reason why these huge fashion brands can't be paying garment workers a living wage, which is what the conversation is moving toward in the fashion industry, is how can we lift wages for garment workers and still make affordable products? Companies can still make their profits. It's entirely possible. And in fact, the price that we pay for clothes, only about 1-3% of the retail price goes to wages. So even if we just increased, workers in, say, Bangladesh or China, if we started to pay them a living wage, the impact on our bottom line as consumers would be so minimal. It would be less than $1 added to the retail price of clothes. So I see what you're saying, but we can't get into the trap of saying, okay, people need jobs and therefore justifying exploitation based on that logic.
I'm talking with Elizabeth Klein. She's the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And so, Elizabeth, when I go into a store or when I shop online and I see an amazing deal, you know, a dress for $12 or something like that, and those deals are out there. They're all over the place. What, from your perspective, should my thought process be besides, oh, that's really cute, and oh, that'll cost me almost nothing?
Well, like Allie and Connor were talking about earlier, it's really interesting to me just in my own life since writing Overdressed, I've found that the more thought that I put into buying my clothes, first of all, I end up saving a lot of money because I don't impulse shop nearly as much. And I also feel like I have a stronger sense of style and a wardrobe that I'm happier with. And the reason that is simple. If you take time to slow down and you're more thoughtful and considerate about what you're going to bring into your wardrobe, then you're going to end up purchasing items that make more sense for your life. So like if you're looking at a dress and you like it and it's on sale, I think that the more thought you can kind of put into that process of saying, okay, where does this fit into my wardrobe? How often am I going to be able to wear this? Even if you just start by asking yourself those simple questions, a lot of times you're going to find yourself walking away from that purchase. So I think it just starts with shopping with more intention and asking yourself, how much use am I actually going to get out of this item?
Do you think that we also need to check the tag and see where it's made and think about buying something that maybe isn't made by people who are making 10 cents an hour?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is, of course, a worthwhile thing to do. And there's actually this really fantastic website called Project Just, projectjust.com, and it takes so much work out of having to look up the environmental and social standards of the companies that you love. So if you're really curious about that, that's a really great place to start. You can type in pretty much any major fashion brand and look and see, are they making, you know, the most basic efforts towards environmental and social responsibility? And I'm always surprised to find out that behind the scenes there are companies that are doing way more than others. Like even if you look at fast fashion companies like H&M and Zara, for example, they both have environmentally conscious collections now. H&M has a conscious collection. Zara has one. I can't think what it's called off the top of my head. But there, you know, some fashion companies are doing way more than others. And it's really important to seek those companies out and to reward them.
And do you think that that's been driven by consumers? What would you credit the change or the development of those kinds of brands?
I think it has absolutely been driven by consumers, especially millennial consumers. They grew up not having to compromise on, you know, quality, affordability, ethics, and sustainability. We've already seen this in the food movement. You can have it all with food. You can, you know, eat responsibly and eat well and eat reasonably affordably. And consumers are demanding the same thing of the fashion industry now. So that's why we're seeing, you know, Nike, for example, has a, I think it's their Flyknit shoe. It's made with 80% less waste in the production process. You know, Patagonia has a lot of products that are made out of recycled materials. And I think all of, excuse me, all of those movements are absolutely driven by consumers. These companies want to please us. They want to make sure that we keep, you know, shopping with them. So I think that we matter a lot.
Now, I think a lot of people, when they go shopping, even if it's something that they're only going to wear a couple of times or they don't see a long-term use for it, we have this sort of thought process that goes through our mind saying, well, I'm going to donate this when I'm mm-hmm. done with it, so it's okay. But there's a high cost to that as well, and we're going to talk about what happens to donated clothing or clothing that is on its way to the landfill in just a few minutes. But give me your take on it. What's wrong with that thread? What's wrong with that idea?
Well, I should say that one thing that I've started doing since writing Overdress is I actually work with a private clothing donation company and recycler in New York City. So part of what I do every week is dig through thousands of pounds of unwanted clothes that are given away by New Yorkers. So I've really learned a lot doing that. I think that one thing that's really important for people to know is that there's 25 billion pounds of unwanted clothing and textiles generated in the United States every year. And that's the amount that could fill about 1.5 million Olympic-sized swimming pools, just to put a visual on that. So we have to stop thinking of unwanted clothes as, you know, our way of helping the less fortunate. Because if you just think about those numbers, it's very clear that we are generating, there's far more supply than demand, right? We are throwing out so much more clothing than could possibly be distributed to those in need in our own country. And in fact, the vast majority of what we end up giving to charities like Goodwill and Salvation Army isn't even resold locally in the retail shops. And that's simply because they get too much. They get too much of it. And I just want to stop there because it's kind of a complicated issue, and I want to make sure that I'm kind of explaining it clearly.
But so you're saying there's just so much that the idea that we're donating it to a local shop that will, you know, hang it on a hanger, turn it around, and that somebody will buy this low-priced item and use it is kind of a fairy tale.
Yeah, and I also think that one thing that is surprising to me is that, you know, a generation ago, when people donated clothes to charity, you would donate clothes clean and in the best possible condition. And I see clothes thrown out that haven't been washed. They have, makeup and food stains on them that someone has clearly not made any attempt to remove. We throw out things with, buttons loose that could have been sewn back on. And it's almost like people don't realize that there's actually a person, you know, that's going to be cleaning those clothes for you and fixing them for you.
We're going to have to pick up in just a second. Elizabeth Klein is with me. She's the author of Overdressed. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As we head into the biggest shopping weekend of the year, we're talking about the high cost of cheap goods, the high cost of cheap fashion, and we're also going to talk about what happens to the things that we buy when we don't want them anymore, focusing on clothes right now. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your experiences. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Elizabeth Klein. She's the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. And Elizabeth, just before the break, we were talking about what happens to this incredible amount of stuff that gets donated, clothing in particular, that gets donated every year. There's so much. You're saying that our idea that if we donate something to the Goodwill or the Salvation Army, that it's going to be turned around and sold in our local community, just doesn't happen because they have so much stuff. So for the stuff that doesn't get sold in the local stores, what happens to it?
Right. So the stuff that can't be or is not resold locally in the charity retail shops, from there it is passed on to companies that are known as textile recyclers or textile graders. They sort everything out and they figure out what is rewearable as clothes and then what's kind of like too stained or torn or beat up. And that portion would be sent off for recycling. And I believe that about 40% can be reworn, and all of that is exported out of the United States. So it is sent to mostly to the developing world. So that's how, you know, if you've ever seen pictures of people in Africa, for example, wearing a marathon t-shirt from New York City, for example, that's how that happens. The export of used clothes from the United States is a huge, huge industry now, and it's growing year after year, and it's really growing in tandem with our consumption of clothes because we are generating more and more and more and more unwanted clothes every year.
Well, and I know that there are implications to that that we could get into deeply as well about, you know, a lot of very cheap goods being dumped on an economy where now local manufacturers of clothes can't compete with those prices. So the ripple effect goes on and on. I want to take a closer look at what happens locally. And Elizabeth, stay with us because I'd love to get your insight on this as well. But we're also going to now welcome Jason Evans to the conversation. He is the director of education at the Cedar Rapids Linn County Solid Waste Agency. Hello, Jason.
Good morning, Charity. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I know that your organization works very hard to manage a lot of this influx of clothing that happens locally. So when clothes come to your site, what happens?
Well, there's a couple different outlets. You know, it's estimated that about 5% of the U.S. landfill space is taken up by clothing. And so we try and divert as much as we can from our local landfill here in Linn County. One of the stops that could be made is, of course, we have 3 Goodwill bins. And I've been listening to Elizabeth talk about the quantity of clothes that go to those Goodwill and Salvation Army shops being so much and so overwhelming that not all of them gets resold. However, if you come out to the landfill and you've brought out textiles that you need to dispose of, you know, the option is we can send them off to Goodwill, or we can put them into the landfill and bury them.
All right, so Goodwill seems like a really good option there if you're taking in stuff that looks like it could be useful, right?
Absolutely, right. We encourage textile recycling, of course. And one thing that we really push out to the public to understand is that recycling is a commodity-driven market. And when those markets exist and there's demand for that material, it's a lot easier to get it recycled and used. And when they dry up, it becomes difficult. Materials that could have been recycled, you know, 6 months ago may no longer be recyclable because there's simply no outlet for them.
So when you go through and look at what you get, other than Goodwill, is there another destination? Are there ways to recycle textiles that don't involve just using the textile in its given form?
Absolutely. You know, we don't sort through those Goodwill bins here on site. We leave that to Goodwill once they're picked up. What we're offering at our site is just an alternative to landfilling them. When we do get those textiles in, you know, we can educate customers as they come through on different ways to use them. Textiles can be, of course, repurposed very easily. With limited sewing skills, you can cut apart good fabric and create new materials from them. We find that about, you know, 45% of the textiles that are being disposed of are actually heading out to those exports that Elizabeth talked about earlier, or to those thrift stores locally. And about 30% of the remaining are recycled into things like rags or other absorbents, shop towels, et cetera. And then the last little bit, and this is something I don't think a lot of people realize, is that the remaining 20% or so of the recycled fibers are used for insulation in new construction. They're used as carpet padding, and they're even used as materials for the automotive industry in creating the interiors of cars that we buy.
So there are possible uses, and it strikes me with the incredible amount that Elizabeth has been talking about that there are probably a lot of people thinking about different innovative ways that we can use these products. Jason, in your experience, have you seen a lot of opportunities for recycling textiles develop and grow?
Sure. The textiles, I think, are an emerging market in the area for sure. In fact, we've been looking at this market very carefully because we would like to take part in it even larger or even greater than we do now. But the agency has in the past worked with Goodwill very closely with a program we called Recycle in Style. And we've put on large fashion shows where all of the clothing that's been on display on the runway has been repurposed. It's either been created from fabrics that were brought in for recycling to Goodwill directly or to the Solid Waste Agency. And it's an effort to educate people and find their creative avenue. You know, we've had dresses made out of nothing but one-time use grocery sacks, and dresses made out of potato chip, Frito-Lay type style sacks.
So, you know, that's cool, but do you really see an impact with something like that? Because if I make a dress out of grocery sacks, I'm probably not going to wear it again after that fashion show.
No, and those are making a statement, of course, at the fashion show. The large majority of the materials that are put on display are actually materials straight off of the Goodwill rack. They're supposed to be showing people that you can be creative. You can create a top or a bottom from material that may not have been a top or bottom prior to that. I know my wife particularly, she sews, and we actually repurpose most of our things like sweaters and shirts. Of course, the easy one you see around, people have those T-shirt bags that they make out of mm-hmm. old T-shirts. You can make blankets out of old fleece materials and other textiles.
And, Elizabeth, I'd love to hear your thoughts on, with the research you've done, you mentioned a few brands that maybe use recycled fibers. I know you mentioned Patagonia, and I know they recycle plastic mm-hmm. into fleece. Do you see a future for this kind of thing?
It is absolutely, I agree with Jason. It's the future of fashion. People in the industry are sort of obsessing about how to so-called close the loop on fashion waste. And here in New York, we have a company called Fab Scrap that has been collecting dead stock from fashion brands in their sampling process and selling that waste to designers to use in new products. I also know there's a children's brand in Los Angeles called Utterly that is also using pre-consumer waste in new designs. There's a UK brand called Beyond Retro that refashions leather and canvas into on-trend accessories. So there are so many new companies, fashion companies, built on this idea of using so-called waste as a raw material. And I think we're going to see larger fashion brands doing the same thing moving forward. I know that Urban Outfitters does it, Reformation in Los Angeles does it. So it's just becoming increasingly popular in the fashion industry. And I think it's a great idea for consumers to think about how they can incorporate that mentality in their own lives as well.
Let's get to the phones. Manny is on the line in Ankeny. Hi, Manny.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, earlier you were talking about the cost of production and the cost of sale. And I would just like to say I used to travel for garment factories down in the Caribbean and Central America, basically just making sure that the price that, well, not the price, but the salary these employees are getting is legal. Unfortunately, comparison to us here in the United States, yes, their pay is a whole lot different, but most garment factories do oblige by whatever local laws they have. What some companies do not do is that they do not do anything extra to provide to those employees or the factories themselves. So basically putting more price on the consumer would not necessarily reflect on their pay later down the road.
So, Manny, what are your thoughts? What do you think would make a difference?
It would make more of a difference if the company itself did more for the employees because they transfer these garment factories down to other countries seeking cheaper labor. However, the price for the consumer has remained the same, if not has increased. Yet their production, their materials has gone up slightly compared to what we are paying here in the United States or any other market like that. So my thought would be for the companies to make more. I know that some are doing a lot with recycling and using reusable materials, but the pay itself, they're only doing as much as they should be.
As much as they're required to do, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay. Well, Manny, thanks a lot for your insight there. And Elizabeth, does that line up with your experience and what you've seen in your travels?
Yes, I absolutely agree with what Manny was saying. That's what I found to be true is that companies are doing the legal minimum, and in most countries, the legal minimum is it's completely legal to pay poverty wages. So, and I think it would be great if brands were either required or took it upon themselves to pay higher wages and not pass it on to consumers. Because if you look at how much profit a lot of these companies are making, they, of course, could afford to do that. So, yeah, I think that's a great plan.
Now, you mentioned earlier the how much garment manufacturing in the United States has shrunk, and it dwindled really quickly from the 1990s to the 2000s. But there's also been a really small bounce back. Do you think that's consumer-driven, with people demanding that their products be made in the United States?
There has been a bounce back, and it's been really exciting to watch. And I think what's so interesting about the Made in America movement, which just quickly, yes, it's partially consumer-driven, and it's also partially because costs are increasing in China and other parts of Asia. But like Made in America clothing is becoming associated with sort of like premium quality heritage quality goods. Especially, I think denim is a really good example. There's a lot of independent premium denim coming. Companies in the United States now. So I think that is so fascinating that we've kind of come full circle back around to this place where America is defining itself as, you know, top of the line for quality. If you want cheap, if you want mass manufactured, sure, buy something from China. But if you buy something that's made in America, it's going to be kind of stamped with that an extra level of care, which I think is really, it's really exciting.
Well, we have only a couple of minutes left. And Jason, I'd love to give you the opportunity. You've seen all these clothes come into your site at the Solid Waste Agency in Linn County. How has that changed your shopping habits?
Well, I actually don't shop a lot for clothing. If you can imagine, I wear things until they're not wearable anymore. And that might be to the chagrin of people around me, but I've never really been all that fashion forward. And I think taking on an attitude of using the things that we have until they are utterly unusable, rather than upgrading to newer, bigger, brighter, sooner, has a large impact. You know, we talk about the three R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle, and you notice recycle at the bottom of those three, because reducing the consumption of the products and reusing them or repurposing them have a much larger positive environmental impact than simply recycling them. There's an energy cost to recycling. And on the lines of people looking for American-made or higher quality or reclaimed fabrics in their products, I think that's a great movement that needs to be pushed forward. I think people look for the environmentally sustainable option when they're shopping. It's often, though, the more expensive option on the shelf. And consumers, I think, have a responsibility to speak with their wallet. And if they're not going to buy the product made with those recyclable materials or materials that are post-consumer already, then, of course, we're going to continue to mass manufacture materials that are made with virgin components.
And Elizabeth, I'll let you respond to that too. How do you think, or how has this shaped your shopping habits, and how do you think it should shape our shopping habits?
I think that, you know, Allie, the student that was on in the beginning of the call, she said something really powerful about making sure that when you buy something, it's not just something that's going to satisfy you for the week, but for longer term. And I think that that's something that we need to take into Black Friday, which is you're going to see the sale prices. You're going to see something glittery and pretty that you really want. But just ask yourself, is this really something that I'm going to be wearing or really love next week? Is it going to be something that I'm really going to love 6 months from now? Is it going to be something that I'm going to love next year? And I think that just by asking ourselves that question, it's going to kind of help us separate the real needs from the wants. And that's what I do in my own life. And I feel better dressed and happier with my clothes, and I have more money as a result.
Elizabeth Klein, thank you.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Klein is author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. Jason Evans, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Charity.
Jason Evans, Director of Education at the Linn County Solid Waste Agency. This is Talk of Iowa.